We all enjoy the benefits of living in a democracy, but do you ever think about whether our democracy is safe? I guess a lot of us assume that just no matter what bumps and upsets it might have, Australian democracy is fundamentally secure. But my next guest, Roberto Foa, says we shouldn't be so sure. He says that across the world, the democratic consensus, as he calls it, is much more brittle than it used to be. He says that public confidence in so-called consolidated democracies like ours and like the US is low, and this is a big problem. Roberto is a lecturer in political science at the University of Melbourne, and he's on the line with me now. Roberto, welcome to Afternoons.
Hi there. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you remind us, first of all, what you mean by the term democratic? What kinds of government are you talking about?
Well, what we have in Western societies is representative democracy. That is to say that we vote for elites who represent our views and take decisions on our behalf. And what we're really looking at today is a kind of malaise or crisis of confidence in Western democracy. We're looking at a sort of dissatisfaction with that particular model of government and how it is working, because many people don't feel that governments aren't taking decisions that truly reflect the popular will, because people feel that they don't really have a fair access, equal access to policymakers, and because of the increasing influence of lobbyists or special interests. So when people look at politics, what they see is a political class that in many ways consists increasingly of career politicians, rather than people who've come from ordinary backgrounds and way of life outside of politics.
Yeah, so this is what you've written about, and you've written a paper which has been very well received with a colleague from Harvard University, Yasha Monk, who, and you talk about the fragility of liberal democracy in all of the liberal democracies of the Western world and Northern America, and Australia is included in that. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the paper explores?
Sure. I mean, you know, we really have this concept in political science of democratic consolidation, which is this notion that once a country has had representative government for a generation or so, democracy takes root. Democratic ideals become infused within the general public. Democratic practices such as joining political parties, voting, engaging in protest against leaders who may be corrupt or abusing public office, that those kinds of norms and attitudes and behaviours become deeply rooted in such a way that the democratic system itself is stable in perpetuity. And one of the things we're really trying to do in this paper is to sort of raise a question mark over that theory of democratic consolidation and start asking the question about how true is that really? I mean, how confident should we be about the long-term stability of Western democracies? And really what we've seen over the last year, particularly with the kinds of illiberal politics that has been rising, obviously in the United States with Donald Trump, in France right now with the Front National and Marine Le Pen, is that, you know, a rise of a new kind of very illiberal kind of politics that we haven't seen in the West, certainly for a very, very long time, and that it, you know, has the potential to sort of turn Western democracies into, if you will, transitional democracies once more.
Mm. So basically, yeah, this idea that political science has held dear, that once you are a democracy, you can't go back. Once you've done democracy, you never go back. But you're basically questioning that and saying it's not so simple. Your research shows that trust, so it's very clearly that trust in democratic institutions has declined over sort of the last few decades. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I mean, it's an observation in political science for quite some time now that we've seen that citizens have registered declining confidence in particular democratic institutions. That is to say that we've seen surveys showing declining confidence in parliament, in the government, in courts, even in the media as well. And we've seen that for some time. I mean, there's been a literature about this for some way back. But what's really quite surprising, and in a sense is our contribution to this debate, is now what we're seeing is in many democracies around the world, in particular among younger people, you see a generation that is actually rejecting certain aspects of the ideal of democracy. So you have people who say, well, it's not so essential to live in a democracy. You have younger generations who are saying that democracy is even a bad way to run the country.
And there's sort of two parts to it, isn't there? There's people, there's a lot of a lack of confidence or a lessening of confidence in the actual institutions like Congress or Parliament in a democracy like England's or Australia's. And then there's a lack of confidence in the sort of corollaries to democracy or the civil society aspects, like the notion that free speech is important or the notion that plurality of multiculturalism is important, or respecting people's, you know, freedom to exercise their religion, that those kind of more fuzzy concepts, if you like.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a very important distinction to be made between democracy and liberal democracy. And, you know, democracy in a very minimal sense is just about having elections and in respecting the outcomes of elections and electoral process. So it's if you are sort of competitive elitism. But liberal democracy is much more than that. It's also about having respect for civil rights and liberties, about respecting the rights of minorities. And there's a qualitative shift that can take place when you move from having the sense the full conception of democracy, liberal democracy, to a kind of democratic politics where politicians start to say that they will violate the rights of minorities, when politicians say that they will take measures against the freedom of the press or that they will crack down on civil society organizations that may be critical of them. Mm. And that's really the start of when democracy begins to erode. And that can be a very slow process. It can be a very gradual process. But it's something that we've seen in transitional democracies all over the world, in Latin America, in Eastern Europe. And we haven't seen that happen in the West. And there's really no reason to think that that might not happen, at least potentially.
Wouldn't you say some of the rhetoric around the US presidential election is sort of going to that very point, that even though the democratic institutions might be firmly in place in a formal sense, there's a bit of an erosion of the norms or the, I suppose, what just the things that we've all taken for granted about the way we speak about our democracy, the way we speak about each other, you know, the adherence to the principles of civil rights, that kinds of thing?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen over the course of the 2016 presidential campaign in the United States is really quite incredible. I mean, it is really not normal to have a presidential candidate, and in fact, a successful presidential candidate, he now will be president of the United States, Donald Trump, who not only, I mean, he calls into question the legitimacy of his of the media, saying that the media is biased and that he will take measures in office to restrict the space of the media. He refuses to talk to the press in many circumstances. He's called into question the integrity of the electoral process and also indicated that had he lost, he wouldn't have accepted the outcome of the election, which is a clear violation of the democratic norm that has always been upheld in the United States. And what's really quite incredible, I think, is that even after he's won the election, you know, he's sending out tweets saying that the electoral process, was rigged and that there were, you know, that he should have won more votes, which is just really quite incredible. We've seen that in developing countries, but we don't see that. We've never seen that in the West.
Yeah, I know the Twitter account plus Donald Trump is a dangerous formula for democracy, perhaps. You draw in your research on data from the World Values Surveys. For listeners who are not familiar with those surveys, can you tell us a little bit about what they are and what they show?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the World Values Survey is the world's longest running global survey of beliefs and attitudes. So it covers now over 100 countries in all parts of the world over a very long period of time, since 1981, in fact, when the project began. So that really makes it a unique data set, simply because it's the only measure we have to be able to track how the attitudes of citizens over a range of issues, including towards democracy, have evolved over the last three or four decades. And that's something that's really, really exciting. And because it is a non-profit academic project, all of the data is freely available to the public. And it's really, really important to keep this project going.
And one of the questions that you ask, or one of the things that you investigate in that survey, is the openness of people to authoritarian alternatives to mm-hmm. democratic rule, such as military rule. And what have you found in that data set over time?
Well, there's some really bizarre findings in there. So for particular countries, such as the United States, we found a rising proportion of individuals who express support for statements like saying that it would be a good thing to have the army rule, to have the army govern this country, which is sort of mind-blowing. So in the US, I mean, that's gone up from 1 in 16 individuals in the mid-1990s to 1 in 6 people in the last survey.
You're listening to Jacqueline Mailey on ABC Local Radio.
We're on Afternoons talking to Roberto Foa, who is a political scientist from the University of Melbourne. We're talking about the fragility of our democracy and democracies. There are generational differences, aren't there, Roberto, in that World Values Survey, in the support that people have for democratic institutions. Can you tell us, it's actually the younger generation who are a little bit more dismissive of democracy than the older generations, isn't that right?
That's right. I mean, what we're seeing is a kind of a disaffection, a sort of democratic malaise among the youth of Western long-standing democracies, that is to say, in the United States, the United Kingdom, also here in Australia, where younger respondents, millennials, are less likely to say that democracy is essential, it's essential to live in a democracy. They're more likely to vote to express approval for statements like saying that democracy, having a democratic political system, is a bad way to run this country. And that's quite a surprising transformation.
Yeah, it's not going to do anything for the sort of generational war between the millennials and the baby boomers either. You also found that millennials are less likely to actively participate in the institutions of liberal democracy, and that doesn't just mean sort of, joining your bog-standard political party like their parents or their parents' parents might have done, but it also means the less conventional forms of participation. So I suppose, the much-vaunted social media participation in political life, millennials are just not really interested in any of it, are they?
I think there is a certain degree to which millennials are logging off from democracy, and I think it's particularly the case in the Anglo-Saxon democracies. And, I think that we maybe have misunderstood the way that social media is transforming politics. We're really seeing now many of the negative ways in which social media is transforming politics. Firstly, in terms of sort of creating these truth silos where people sort of disappear into their own particular partisan perspective without having the possibility to really exchange views with people of different political orientations and develop some kind of consensus. And I think another thing as well is, the sort of online activism. Maybe that's not what it was really wanted to be. We're seeing that maybe people clicking that they like something or signing an online petition, but actually that's taking away perhaps from some of the direct action, direct democratic action, going on protests and sending letters to MPs and that kind of thing that used to exist more in the past.
It's very sort of performative too, isn't it? If you like something on Facebook, then everyone can see it, but you don't actually have to do much about it. Where I suppose if you write a letter to your politician, no one really sees it except that politician. So you don't get the kudos, perhaps. Do you think it's just that the young millennials have had it too good? They've known nothing but stable democracy, and they've taken their freedom for granted because it's never been threatened in their lifetime.
I actually don't think that the young have it too good. I think what you see in many Western societies today is you see young people who are in debt. There's widespread underemployment. Work contracts are more precarious than they used to be. Many young people are locked out of the housing market. So in a way, actually, it really makes sense. It's a very logical response that when you feel you have nothing to lose, you want to shake the system. And that's really the core of populism. Populism is not just about the redistribution of income. It's really about the redistribution of rage.
Does this mean then that, young people are going to be more susceptible to or more accepting, say, of a military coup or something like that if it happens in their lifetime? Or will they change their views as they get older?
Well, I don't think that there's going to be a military coup in any Western society, at least not in the imminent future. But what I would
never say never, Roberto.
Never say never. I know that's now on record, and that may not happen. That may happen, and I'll be proven false. But when democracies die, they tend to die quietly. Mm. Democracies don't die because a lot of people had a serious debate and decided that they'd rather try something else, such as having the army rule. No. They die because political elites do subvert the system. They do take illiberal actions once they get into office. And citizens are ultimately too cynical and too passive to oppose it. And we see that with military coups. Now, again, this is something we have experience of in developing countries, not in the West. And it happens all the time. And we've seen it in the survey data as well. So when the World Value Survey surveyed Pakistan in 1997, there were a large proportion of individuals who said they would be fine with a military coup. And 2 years later, there was a military coup.
Right.
And nothing happened. There were no protests in the streets. Nobody cared. And so I think that's the kind of danger that kind of passivity and cynicism can engender.
Well, which brings us to our next point, because you mentioned quite heavily in your research the influence of lobbyists and interest groups over policy making, and you basically, I think if I'm reading it right, you find that these interest groups and lobbyists have been able to exert such a strong influence on policy that the average citizen has pretty much no say, no sort of zero, I think you say zero net effect on policy making. I guess you're talking particularly about the US. But can you tell us a little bit more, or tease out some of that research a bit more?
Sure. I mean, I think you have had this very subtle transformation in the political life of Western democracies over the last generation. You know, increasingly today, you have career politicians rather than politicians who made it, who were successful in a trade union or a business and then in later life went into politics. One consequence of that is that lobbyists, because you have this political machine now, you know, lobbyists have greater access to politicians than they used to in the past. And I think also, you know, in a society where you have rising inequality, as we have rising inequality for a generation now in the West, money always makes its way into the political system eventually. Money always finds a way in. And once it gets into politics, it's very, very difficult to get it out again.
So if you're an average citizen, say, in America, and you want to get your interests, you've got a particular bugbear, or, I don't know, you're having trouble with the health system, or you can't get your child educated or something, it's essentially impossible to exert any real influence over the policy makers in Washington in the way that someone with big bucks and good connections could. That's what you're saying.
I think that's right. And I think we've seen that in the United States, there's a growing proportion of Americans over a generation who've become disconnected and disillusioned with the politics of Washington, D.C. They say they're not so interested in politics. They don't support one of the major parties. And that creates a very dangerous dynamic because it creates a kind of superficial stability to the political system. But actually, there's this really large pool of people out there who are angry. And when you have a politician, if you have a demagogue who comes along and says, I will be your voice, I will speak for you, I will smash the system, I will change the system, suddenly you can have a really large proportion of people getting behind that movement. And you know, we've seen that. You know, we've seen that in developing countries. We saw that with Hugo Chavez, for example, in Venezuela. And now, you know, we're seeing that that can also happen in the West.
Indeed. And I guess it's like, you know, people feel their vote has been devalued over a period of time, and then they see someone who's really going to smash a hammer blow through the whole system, so they think their vote can count for once. I know that you're not, Roberto, you're not an expert in Australian politics per se, and you're a relative newcomer to the country. I think you only got here last August.
That's right.
So I'm not going to put you on the spot too much about local conditions, but people often say, I suppose, about Australian democracy that we are fairly secure and okay here because we have unique conditions. We have compulsory voting, for example. So, people find it a lot harder just legally to opt out of the system. And also we've had good economic conditions. We've had, I think it's 25 years of economic growth as opposed to other countries like Britain or the United States that have dipped in and out of recession. Do you think those things are enough to insulate our democracy and make us secure in our democratic freedoms and institutions?
I think Australia has been a very lucky country over the last generation. Australia, you know, hasn't had a recession, hasn't had to experience the aftershocks of the global financial crisis like countries in Europe, like the United States have. But I also think that might risk a certain complacency on the part of Australians regarding the stability of the political system here. I don't see any reason why potentially 10 years or 20 years down the line, or maybe even 5 years down the line, that, you know, if Australia, you know, if conditions do change here economically in terms of the stability of the financial system in Australia, if Australia follows the kind of path that other Western democracies have gone down economically, I see absolutely no reason why you couldn't have that same kind of rise of populism. And I think that in Australia as well, and we've seen it in our data, you know, there is a lot of cynicism there, that younger Australians in particular do have very sceptical, very cynical attitudes about the political system.
Mm. Yeah, certainly the trend that you saw across the world, Australia was not at all immune from that trend. In fact, we followed the same trend lines as the US and Europe. I mean, what do you think the future holds for democratic institutions, given that we're seeing this trend of you know, a growing contempt towards democracy and all that it represents? Do you fear for our future in that sense?
I think we're undergoing a systemic shift right now. The rise of populism as a political movement is going to transform Western politics for a generation. And it will continue. It will continue as long as the kind of trends, such as rising income inequality and wealth inequality, rising disparities between regions of countries, between those that are urban centers that are connected to the global economy and other parts of the country in the US or the UK or here, that feel left behind. And as long as those trends continue, then populism will be able to find a large number of supporters. So a lot of people ask me, what will this look like? Are we going back to the 1930s? But I really think that the best comparison is almost a geographic comparison, that the future of Western politics is going to look a lot more like what we've seen in a region like Latin America over a long period of time, where populism has a really long history, and in a way that has a much longer history of trying to maintain or not maintain democratic institutions in the context of a society that has deep social inequalities and also, to some degree, class and ethnic tensions.
But I mean, a lot of those countries, people would look at them and see them as sort of violent and chaotic, and as you say, with enormous wealth disparities, enormous amounts of poverty, and very sort of always, as you say, dipping in and out of democracy. Do you really think that's what the future could hold for the West?
I think it's the path we're on. And I think that, in some ways, the United States has been further down this path. I mean, when you look at income inequality in the United States, it's starting to approach the levels that you see in countries in Latin America. And inevitably, that changes the nature of democracy. When there is no longer a middle class, there is no longer a middle ground, there is no longer a median voter. So there's no longer a political center. And we've seen that in the U.S. And again, it's incredible in the last campaign about, Donald Trump has reintroduced the term the working class to American politics. He said, I'm going to be the candidate of the working class, not the middle class, the working class. And so, yes, when you have a large number of individuals who feel like they have nothing to lose, then they will and be happy to overturn the system.
Won't there be a backlash, though, when politicians, possibly Donald Trump will fall prey to this, when populist politicians promise all sorts of things to an electorate, they get into power and they can't possibly deliver all the things that they promise, possibly because those things are contradictory and contradict each other, or they're economically not sustainable, like bringing back manufacturing jobs to a highly industrialized Western economy like the US is just not possible. Won't the electorate kind of figure them out?
No. And this is what people don't understand about populism. Populism is not about redistribution of income. Populism is about redistribution of anger. It is about redistribution of rage. It is about having a large number of individuals in society who feel hurt, who feel humiliated, who feel like they don't have a life that they can be proud of. And they see a politician come along who is prepared to redistribute their anger and their feelings of hurt upon other individuals in society, whether that's ethnic minorities, whether that's perceived political and economic elites. And that is why people voted for Donald Trump. And that is all he has to do to maintain his support base, is to continue going on Twitter, to continue attacking people, to continue attempting to humiliate America's political class, to continue triggering angry responses from cosmopolitan liberal America. And, he's doing that. He's going back on the campaign now. He's continuing his rallies. He's continuing his tweets. And his base love it.
So what you're saying is it's more of an emotional reaction that people are seeking rather than actual practical change in their lives in terms of healthcare and jobs. I mean, this is anathema to a lot of politicians in the middle ground.
That's right. But this is how populism operates. And we've seen it in country after country, right? I mean, just in the same way that in Greece, when Tsipras organized the referendum against the European Union, whipped up a huge frenzy of people to say no to Europe. And then when he got the result he wanted, when he got his no, he went and signed the treaty with Brussels anyway. Now, people who think about politics in a kind of logical frame think that that was a failure or a disaster. But no, you have to put yourself into the psychology of populism. It is about making a statement. It is about annoying people. It's almost like this kind of punk politics, right? It's about saying things you don't believe. That's what it is.
Annoying people.
Yeah. And that's what populism is all about.
I didn't have you pegged as a punk, Roberto, but now I do.
I'm not a
An unlikely punk / political scientist.
Yeah, you don't know my music collection. So.
Well, is there anything that leaders, sort of sensible leaders who, you know, the rare, shall we say, politicians who actually do want to make a difference and do want to better people's lives on the ground, is there anything that they can do to restore faith in democratic institutions now when it's looking kind of tenuous?
It's pretty clear that representative democracy isn't something of a malaise right now. So what can politicians do? Well, I don't know for certain, but I suppose there are two avenues, right? So the first would be to risk more democracy, to have more direct democracy, less power for international institutions like the European Union, having more referendums, having populists in power and giving people, in a sense, what they want. And that is going to take us down an interesting road that potentially could take us somewhere like Switzerland, where, you know, this kind of direct democracy politics has been institutionalized for a long time and is certainly fairly stable. But it could also take us down a road to something more like Latin America, and then we'll end up seeing more kind of Hugo Chavez type populists of the left, or indeed populists of the right as well, influencing politics. So that's one possible road. Mm. And I suppose the other avenue is to go completely in the opposite direction, which is to go for an even more extreme kind of undemocratic liberalism than what we have right now, which, of course, is what Renzi tried to achieve with his referendum that failed in Italy, which is to go for a system of politics, actually, that is more technocratic. And that's been done in the past. I mean, Charles de Gaulle did that in France in the 1960s when he abolished the Fourth Republic and had introduced a more kind of technocratic politics in France. So that's another avenue, but how exactly you get there and how stable that will be in the long run, I don't know.
And the last question I want to ask you is a very personal one, because the media is often blamed for eroding democracy, or for either being too right-wing or too left-wing, for polarising people, for emitting untruths. Is there anything that journalists can do, rightly or wrongly, to sort of shore up faith in democracy?
Journalists have to be honest and do their job, and, you know, certainly not putting out, you know, one of the things we're seeing, of course, in this sort of age of post-factual politics is, you know, false news. And the temptation, of course, is always to propagate false news, because journalists have to get an audience and they have to work with the material that they have. So journalists have an essential role in making liberal democracy work by acting as the filters for public debate and public discourse. So journalists have to keep doing what they're doing, and journalistic organizations, that is to say the television and newspapers, have to remain an important part of democratic debate and democratic processes.
Well, I certainly hope I've done my duty by you and by liberal democracy this afternoon. It's been so interesting to talk to you, Roberto. Roberto Foa is a lecturer in political science at the University of Melbourne and has just finished, is it a PhD at Harvard?
In these
democratic institutions and the fragility of our democracy. Roberto, thank you very much and enjoy your afternoon.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be on air.